morning, everyone. When we hold our retreats or sessions, we have two formal meals. We have breakfast and lunch. And so before those meals, we recite some meal sutras together. And then at the end of the meal, we have another one. And the one at the end of the meal is like this. May we exist like a lotus, at home in the muddy water. Thus we bow to life as it is. So I'd like to unpack that a little bit and have offer some reflections on that. The lotus is a, as you, I'm sure you're aware, a very, very important symbol in Buddhism and also many other cultures. So it's revered throughout Asia. Also ancient Egypt had a lot of symbolism around the lotus and the early Greeks. And it's just one of those sort of universal symbols that when we see it, we kind of go, oh yeah, you know, I know what that means. And so it's often said to symbolize the purity of the enlightened mind amidst the suffering of samsara. So there's our life and all the messiness, the mud, samsara, and then out of that comes a beautiful lotus. And in Tibetan Buddhism, the main mantra is Om Mani Padme Hum. And it's engraved everywhere, including on rocks and in stones. And especially older Tibetans, when you see them, they often have the prayer beads and they're going, Om Mani Padme Hum, Mani Padme Hum. And so people repeat it hundreds and thousands of times. And Om Mani Padme Hum, a sort of loose translation, is Hail to the Jewel in the Lotus. And then another text that's very influential in Mahayana Buddhism is the Lotus Sutra. And that was one of the, I think it was actually the last teaching of the Buddha, or at least a very late one. And it's a very influential text, and it really talks about that Buddhahood or enlightenment is open to all. So it's not just the monastics, but anyone can have enlightenment. And we also have a few sutras that mention the lotus. So the one we had this morning, Tori Zenji's Bodhisattva's Vow. At the peak of each thought, a lotus flower opens, and in each flower there is revealed a Buddha. Everywhere is a pure land in its beauty. We see fully the Tathagata's radiant light right where we are. In the Yarra Valley, there's a lotus garden. I don't know if anyone's been there. It's not actually a garden. David's been there. It's not a garden. It's like a huge park. It's worth visiting. You have to go at the time of the year when they actually flower, but it's just pond after pond after pond of lotus flowers. And it's quite an amazing sight, you know. So when you see hundreds of these lotus flowers, it's really quite stunning and very beautiful. So it's, and they're all there, and that, you know, they have the big leaves, and then they're just sort of floating effortlessly above the water, and it looks very beautiful and very graceful. And so there is this notion that, you know, even though there's a mud there which is dirty, there's a sense of purity which kind of floats above the mud. But when you really sort of unpack that a little bit, that's potentially a bit problematic. And so one of the things about this notion of purity is that actually, for instance, fascism as a philosophy has this notion of purity. So this idea that there's things wrong with life, and that's because there's impure elements around. And if you get rid of those impure elements, then things will be okay again. And that's basically what the notion is. And of course, every culture has different notions of what this impurity might be. So often it's been women. So women have periods, so that's a bit messy. And then childbirth is even messier, so they're impure. Or it could be a particular race or a particular religion. But basically, there's this notion that something is impure, but this notion of purity is actually possible. So I'd like to turn my attention from the lotus and look at the mud, which is actually the mud underneath it. And what does it actually mean to be at home in the mud or the soil? So soil is one of those. I've been reading a few books about soil, including one by Matthew Evans, which is called Soil, the Incredible Story of What Keeps Us and the Earth Healthy. And like Matthew Evans and other people have said, soil has a bit of an image problem. So we think it's dirty, it's yucky, and it's pretty boring. So it's just there and sort of plants just happen to grow from it. And in fact, soil science is not very well funded, which is quite amazing, considering we all depend 100% on soil actually keeping us alive. When you get a single teaspoon of soil, so rich garden soil, not depleted soil, it can hold up to 1 billion bacteria, several yards of fungal filaments, several thousand protozoa, and scores of nematodes. So this is one teaspoon. This is not like the big. And there's also a very strong symbiotic relationship between plants and bacteria and between the microorganisms. And so, for instance, like, it's quite hard to tell where the roots of the plants finish and the soil begins, because there's all this bacteria and fungi sort of having this relationship. And then the soil can use some of the bacteria to extract nutrition. But also when it's being attacked, it can actually get other bacteria to defend the plant and things like that. And then there's also that network of fungi, which passes messages from one plant to the other plant underneath and things like that. So it's really, really complex and really, really rich. And so for 400 million years, plants have been forming this symbiotic relationship with the fungi that colonize the roots. And so that extends the potential reach of the plant 100-fold. So the plant is there, and then it actually has this enormous range as well. And they've channeled nutrients and water back to the plant cells, but they also connect the plants and enable them to communicate with one another and set up defense systems and signal plants. So Matthew Evans, in an interview, said about writing this book on the soil. So as probably most of you know, he's... he was a food critic and then moved to Tasmania to start farming and look at, you know, where the food comes from. And then he's written, he's also got a degree in applied science, something like that. So he does actually know how to read the research as well. So he said, it was part of my ambition to make soil, if not sexy, then at least interesting. This idea that soil is just something that gets under your nails or something you have to rinse off the carrots, it belittles it. Talking about all these big picture things, about what happens in soils and about what it does, is the way to make it relevant. Because until we care about soil, until we know its stories, we're not going to do anything to improve its fate. And we're losing topsoil at an enormous rate. So it takes millions of years to create good, fertile topsoil. And in the last 200 years, you know, in Australia, I think about half of it's already been lost. And then he talks about there's this obsession with Mars when we're turning parts of the world into a moonscape. There's this idea that we need to find another place to live, which essentially doesn't even have any topsoil and can't support us. All the money and effort that's going into it, whether it's Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk or whoever. And on the other hand, these underfunded soil scientists are struggling to comprehend the very thing that has nurtured us since the beginning of time. And so I read another other book, you know, we've got the Mars rover, but we actually need an Earth rover that starts to examine what's actually happening on our planet Earth here. So this idea that, we can sort of transcend that muddiness and the soil and have some sort of a sense of purity can be potentially problematic. And, you know, we probably, most of us know about Carl Jung, and so he was a Swiss psychotherapist, and he talked about the notion of the shadow. And so it's aspects of us that we don't really like, that we find problematic. And so one thing we can do with that shadow is project it out to others. And that's what, you know, this idea of purity is, that someone else has to carry that for us. Or we can get to know it and integrate it. And so the idea with what he calls individuation is this process where we start to examine those parts of us where we are not so comfortable, get to know it, but then also integrate it into the whole of our personality. So the other part of that verse is, it starts, may we exist like a lotus at home in the muddy water, thus we bow to life as it is. So that sense of being with life as it is, including those aspects of us that we find problematic. And so I was also thinking about that sense of bowing to life as it is. In secular mindfulness, we have one of the core attributes is called acceptance. And it's really that sense of accepting this is how life is and this is what actually, you know, is happening right now. And I was just sort of reflecting on that, and I thought it's sort of one thing to have acceptance, but it feels somehow different to actually bow to that. Not just to say, yes, this is how life is, almost a bit like an observer or standing back, but to actually bow to it. So what does it actually mean? And it's almost like there's quite a somatic difference about how we engage with those aspects of our life as it is. So just like the lotus, bowing is the key sort of principle in Buddhism. And my initial exposure to Buddhism was Tibetan Buddhism. And they take the bowing very seriously. And that's a full prostrations. And they actually aim to do thousands and thousands of them. So it's, you know, they might spend, you see them in front of monasteries just doing this bowing practice. Also, they do pilgrimages where you do full prostration, get up, take a step, another one, get up, take a step, you know, and they might do that for weeks or months. And they have ways of counting on the mala beads, so, you know, how many thousands have done, how many thousands more to do. And I was actually wondering if nowadays I have an app to keep track. They probably do. So we used to actually do full prostrations in our group here. And then eventually Jeff Dawson, our teacher, sort of felt it was a bit culturally awkward, perhaps, or maybe that's not quite the right word, but, you know, decided just to do gassho rather than the full prostrations. But personally, I still actually like doing full prostration. So when I do my meditation at home, I still do three. And I just, there's something about that practice, you know, often it's described as a way to embody respect, humility, love, and just that sense of a little dropping away of the ego. And Dogen apparently said, as long as there is true bowing, the way of the Buddha will not deteriorate. So there we are. So, yeah, I was just reflecting on all these different aspects of the Meal Sutra. And so I've written an alternative one. And when I say alternative, I'm not actually proposing that we use it. So it's a bit tongue-in-cheek. And it's not very poetic, so we definitely won't be using it. But I'll just read the first one again and then the one that I've sort of come up with after my reflections. So the first one is, may we exist like a lotus, at home in the muddy water, thus we bow to life as it is. And so another possible version. May we exist like the mud, which is full of vitality and fascinating interconnections to many forms of life, and which also happens to support the lotus, which is a very pretty flower, but which can distract us from taking good care of the soil if we get too caught up in notions of purity and perfection instead of appreciating the life we do have. Thus we bow to the soil, which we can nourish and support for understanding and respecting our interbeing with nature. Thank you.